When we become aware of something, when we know something or have an imprint of some knowledge within our psyches, within our minds in some way, that gain or possibly a loss of knowledge, that is a probability effect. That's when you know it's heads or you know it ain't heads. That's a probability effect. That's when probabilities change according to what you see or what you observe. So knowledge is what happens or what you get from the awareness that something has happened. Now, awareness is a two-pronged action. One, when a possibility changes into a probability, that's awareness. And two, when a probability changes itself. A probability can change into a certainty or it may not. If not, it can become less certain or it can become more certain. I will at times say the word consciousness to mean the same thing as awareness. Knowledge is the outcome of consciousness. It isn't consciousness itself. It's the outcome of consciousness. It's what consciousness or awareness produces. Knowledge can be thought of as something tangible, something physically real. In fact, when we have knowledge, our brain structure is changed to accommodate that knowledge. Generally, we experience knowledge as a memory of something. We know something because it enters our so-called memory. However, knowledge can change. The probability that it was this rather than that can change when somebody else says, "Oh no, you didn't eat that fish last night. What you ate was some chopped herring." "Oh, but I remember I had whitefish." No. "Oh, well, I guess you're right. I ate herring. Maybe that's why my stomach and I'm burping so much today." So your knowledge can change. The probability that it's one rather than the other can change because of other knowledge you might gain. Okay? So awareness or consciousness can change something which is less certain, which is just probable, into something more certain, or it can be changed into less certain. For example, I'm certain I had chopped herring last night. "Oh, no. You had whitefish." And then you turn to the next person at the table. "What did I eat?" "You had whitefish." "Oh, my God, I'm starting to remember I had whitefish. Oh, maybe I did have whitefish." And suddenly the knowledge that you had herring starts to vanish, disappear. So knowledge represents a specific outcome of such an action and is subject to change. All knowledge is subject to change. Knowledge can change. In fact, in science, the whole game of science is to continually change knowledge as we learn more. We want to learn more and we want to change what we think we know. So that's what science is all about. We may know something about an object in 1 minute, and an attempt to gain more knowledge about the object, we may lose some of that knowledge we had originally thought we had. Okay. Thus, if a choice is made and an attempt is made to carry out or to observe an object or information about that object, we may find that by looking at it a different way, we no longer see it as we saw it before. In other words, there are different, sometimes opposing, or sometimes called complementary ways of observing, and in so doing, we can actually change knowledge. This is called, in quantum physics, the principle of complementarity. And it's a very important principle because we can use it to alter the perceptions we have of ourself. We can use it to change how we think. What we need to learn, of course, is to not think about the things we think about in the same way that we normally tend to think about them. So, these are all things which can take place. But at a deeper level, and this is where we get into the deeper psyche, this is where the time is really being created. All that stuff out there is pretty much in the out there world as far as knowledge is concerned. But this world we're talking about now is in the world of possibility. And in that world, things can change and have rather striking differences. And I'm going to try to make this as clear as I can in what's following. Now, there's a famous experiment in quantum physics, which is called the double slit experiment, in which particles of light or subatomic particles are shined into a wall which has two openings in it. And after the particles hit this wall, they either get absorbed by the wall or they pass through one or both of the two holes and then they land on a screen. And we can look at the screen where the particles finally land and look at the pattern that these particles make when they land on the screen. And from that pattern, we can learn something about, first of all, what the particles are doing, and second of all, what happens when they go through the holes. Now, if these particles turn out to be not particles, but waves, then a single wave can actually go through both openings in the wall at the same time. And when that happens, the waves that come out are each coming out from each separate hole in the wall, and they each have their own wave pattern, which means they're each undulating up and down. And because they travel by slightly different lengths to get to a point on the final screen, these waves can arrive in such a way that they're interfering with each other so that when the crest of one wave arrives, the valley of the other arrives and they cancel each other out. So all the waves going to that point cancel each other out. On the other hand, just move a little bit to down the screen or up the screen from that point, and at that point, the waves, even though they're traveling different paths, they could arrive in such a way that the crests come together and the valleys come together. There was like a harmony. They sing together in harmony or out of harmony. And depending on whether they do or not, we have a darkening on the screen of where these waves hit. Okay? And if we do this with waves, with actual waves of something or other, we could actually see this pattern, and it's called a wave pattern. But if we are using particles, which are called electrons or photons or something else, and we shine them through, what happens then? Well, what's really amazing is that if we shine these particles through one at a time, so that when a particle comes to the two holes in the wall, it can, logically speaking, only go through one or the other, then it should land on the screen. And if we fire another one and then another one and then another one, we look at the pattern of the spots that land, it should look nothing like a wave pattern. We should find nothing that looks like waviness, but that's not what we find. What we find is exactly the same thing as waviness. What this tells us is that objects that we normally think of as always being objects, when we're not looking at them, actually go into the realm of waves of possibility. They're waving in possibility land, and they can interfere with each other because of that. There's places where they can cancel out. And this tells us that we are able to affect the reality of what happens to the particles when they land on the screen, that is, where they land on the screen, for example, by simply controlling the holes in the screen, in the wall, and where the holes are drilled. If we close one of the holes down, we don't see this pattern anymore. If we close the other one down and open the other one, we don't see the same pattern. If we leave both of them open, we do. So we can control whether we see it more wavy or more particle-like, more probability-like, or more possibility-like, depending upon what we do. We have a power that way. Well, because these possibility waves can do this interference dance, the question naturally occurred is, are these really waves in space? Are they physically? Are they really there? And in spite of all of our attempts to try to find their physicalness, they don't seem to be something physical. Yet they have this manifestation for us of objects which do appear when they change from possibilities into probabilities. And it's that change, the squaring process that I told you about a little before this, that is most important as we begin to look at how the time and mind are affected by probability.